Greetings, comrades. A special announcement from the Measures Taken headquarters. We began this project over 2 years ago with the intention of excavating and restoring a proper intellectual history of Marxism and sharing our results with fellow travelers. Along the way, we wanted to demonstrate a healthy model of self-education, as well as open a conversation with our potential listeners. This podcast has had some successes. We have, for example, learned an enormous amount. We have also always enjoyed and been grateful for the support and encouragement you've given us. However, it has not been lost on us nor all of you that the project in its current iteration is unsustainable. Our research model and episode structure is so intensive and unwieldy that it takes months to prepare for each episode, and as a result, each episode is stretched to the breaking point of scope and density. This isn't good for anyone, and we want to reach a point of consistent output without any sacrifice in quality. We may also have underrated our ability to obsess and comb over minutiae in what is, after all, an enormous historical era. This means the timeline for our study and recording reaching, say, the end of the 1920s, let alone the present day, appears further and further down the line. For all these reasons, as well as, and this is the confessional part, a desire to actually become a show that has a remote possibility of being popular and generating the conversations with you all that we'd like, we have modified how we will work going forward. We will now have three types of episodes, each running on a distinct track alongside one another. The first continues the project as it has been thus far, an intellectual history of the development of Marxism. The second will address itself mostly to discrete texts, so that listeners can more easily follow along and so that the breadth of episodes does not become totally unmanageable. We are calling these episodes Beach Reading, and one along these lines will soon appear, dedicated to Nikolai Bukharin's historical materialism. A third track will address itself to the contemporary left. We will try our absolute best not to be in the business of generating hot takes, but in order to prove that our project is not strictly of historical or niche interest, we feel it is necessary to bring our work into direct conversation with the political universe we currently inhabit. Each of these episodes will discuss the work of our contemporaries. We are calling this track The World According To. This is the first of those episodes. We really aspire to release episodes more than twice a year and on a more consistent basis going forward. More developments will be announced as they develop, but until then, last but not least, we deeply appreciate you all. Tell your friends. Finally, after all that, this is The Measures Taken. All right, friends. Well, here we are, the first World According To. One of my favorite questions to ask the two of you, what have we been thinking about lately?
I've been thinking about the end of capitalism and how many times it's happened.
Yes, because you, that's a tease, but that's because you have been absorbing the work of our favorite Marxist iconoclast.
Our favorite erratic Marxist,
actually. Erratic Marxist, Yanis Varoufakis.
Yes, I have.
Who's something of a celebrity for the last 10 years or so.
Well, you see, the algorithms, they know me too well, and they've given me a lot of opportunity to go to Vimeo and pay Vimeo some money and then give other people my password so they can watch this 6-part documentary, called In the Eye of the Storm, which, well, I mean, look, what is it? It's a sleek hagiography of someone that, you know, if you had to pick someone to treat like a saint, you could do worse than Yanis Varoufakis. Dude actually did some heroic shit, you know, for a while. But yeah, no, it's about his career in Syriza, the reasons for his resignation, the reasons for the collapse of Syriza, and then two episodes which are finer than the others because they stray away from biography and focus on what Yanis actually thinks about the economy. And I was comforted that he doesn't do any in that, I mean, you know, jokes aside, in that documentary, he doesn't do any arguments about techno-feudalism. He doesn't try to attack value theory. He doesn't try to defend anything like an erratic approach to Marxism. It's actually a popularization of some of the basic assumptions that almost all socialists share. So for that reason, you know, there are worse gateway drugs.
I am interested in the book that you referenced, but I want to stick on the Syriza documentary, because one of the things that we're going to talk about, because I've been very embedded in reading a lot of this like small cottage industry of books looking back at the sort of post-recession, you know, the 2008 to 2020 left, which is usually grouped under this like umbrella term called like left populism. And there's a lot of books on that, which kind of return us to how we understand like the sequence that we all actually lived through. It's fun to read histories of events that were actually formative in your own political life. And so people drawing conclusions from those is very interesting. A lot has been written about Syriza since their capitulation. In fact, they're now led, obviously their capitulation years ago, but for those of you who haven't been keeping up with Syriza in the news, they are now led by a registered Republican former investment banker, who is moving the party to the right. Just didn't know there was farther right to move, but it is in fact entered a stage of pure, decrepitness.
An old word for that.
But I am curious, because a lot of the books that I read also reflect on the Syriza experience as one of the constituent parts of this sort of populist upsurge or populist turn that the left attempted. And I'm curious if Varoufakis has, any self-reflections on what does he make of the Syriza experience? Or does he just say I did a good job, I did the best I could? I mean,
I think, can I just add to that question? It'll be in the same, kind of along the same lines, because what I read for this time was kind of the left press that is kind of the most popular and in the limelight. So I read the winter 2024 issue of Jacobin, which the theme was AI, and I also read a few things from the New Left Review and things like that. And so what I've been thinking of broadly is kind of the audience for a left press that is unmoored from any class organization and necessarily unmoored given the situation that we're in. And so my question that I think can go in tandem with Nathan's about the documentary is if there are kind of lessons or self-critical reflections or anything like that from Yanis Varoufakis in the documentary, who do you feel like it's oriented toward? Like, what is the audience for this? What are we supposed to do with these lessons? Because this is constantly, I think, the vexing question when there's something produced for socialists in the absence of enduring organizations that kind of mature and take in these lessons, and instead, whether it's just, you know, kind of oriented towards people's individual reflections that hopefully one day they will take into some sort of organization.
So. Yeah, I kept thinking of that when I was watching this thing, because I'm not the ideal viewer in one sense. I followed the Syriza experience closely when it was happening. I followed Yanis Varoufakis' career after that. And even his own writing has had a pretty intense, let's put it this way, a pretty lasting influence on me. One point in particular, and this just to say something nice about Yanis for a moment before I answer your question fully, which is, his book Adults in the Room, which is, you know, his autobiographical take of what it was like to negotiate in the Eurogroup, which is quite the loosely organized clown car, was eye-opening for me, because while I suspected that there were no adults in the room, as it were, that everyone was, just in it for their own career advancement, or that these meetings among government officials were taken over by discussions of the press release that would result from their meeting and didn't ever debate ideas, right? I didn't imagine that these were a bunch of academics or anything, although that might be worse. I didn't understand the sort of the depth of incompetence. This is, I think we are a couple generations deep in a phenomenon, by which the reinforcement structures that have allowed people to rise up the ranks have become so corrupt that it is rare to find someone of substance. But your point is well taken, which is, who's this for? It can't be for me, because I didn't need the summary. But right. It can't not be for me, because if you're not already on the left and already in this media sphere and already in that algorithmically, triangulated circle, then you haven't heard of this at all. Right. So I don't know how to answer your question.
And he doesn't conduct some kind of excavation or autopsy of Syriza and suggest an alternative strategy that the left could have pursued.
Yeah,
or,
he does.
Or a mea, is there any mea culpa?
Yes, there is. In fact, there is explicitly, there is a section of the documentary where the documentary maker, who's never on screen, asks, were there any mistakes? And then flashes to a bunch of reporters over the course of years asking him the exact same question, were there any mistakes? And of course, there are any number of mistakes. But because Yanis Varoufakis, let's put it this way, it's framed with the imprisonment and torture of his father. So the theme is, here is a heroic individual who, against all odds, became a politician, but didn't let it corrupt him, which is how he got to the moment that he resigned. And also that has to do with the self-styling, right? The motorcycle and the t-shirts and the rest of it. He was always, he had this like individualist spirit about him. the opposite of party discipline, actually. But he's asked, you know, what did you do wrong? And I think the thesis by the end is, well, we try to win power in only one country. So the rest, I mean, the last episode is all about internationalism. The theme is the DiEM25.
Right, because he's turned into this sort of like pan-European mass democracy movement.
And he's always been this guy who believes in international organizations. This is why he opposed Brexit, but also opposed those who criticized those who voted for Brexit. He's you know, hewing this line.
I'm curious to what extent... Okay, do we want to stay on Varoufakis and talk about his new book?
I think maybe, yeah, a couple more things on him would be interesting.
Yeah,
I mean, one...
Should have been Varoufakis.
Because you know, his book on techno-feudalism, I'm
so Yanis Varoufakis has a new book. It's called Techno-Feudalism, What Killed Capitalism.
Right.
And
it's one in a long lineage of we are no longer in capitalism revelations. One would think that if we are indeed in a new era and no longer in capitalism, there would necessarily have to be a reassessment of one's strategy for any kind of emancipatory project. So it's kind of interesting for that not to have come up in that documentary. I mean, I don't know what we make of that leap there. It's a common one. It's got plenty of historical precedent. We have tumbled our way out of capitalism by its critics, no shortage of time over the years.
It is quite a curious maneuver. On one hand, there is just the ironic aspect, which you keyed in on, which is that there's been no one more enthusiastic like Marxist to describe that we are not somehow in the capitalist mode of production. The thing that's very interesting there is, like, on one hand, we've basically been told that after 1991, the collapse of communism, all not just like the organizations and institutions that were wedded to that particular side of the Cold War, but all of the strategic and theoretical repertoire that was attached to Marxism and that part of the ideological battle, that's also like gone down with the ship, as it were. So the need to create some kind of alternative theoretical model after the collapse of communism is compensated for to some extent by suggesting it's not because communism was defeated that we need to create new strategy, but now we're outside of capitalism entirely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in some ways, this kind of goes back to a recurring theme that we've talked about here, which is this desire to erect a new model or a new stage or a new concept due to some sort of changing conditions. It's like there's such an understandable hesitation to have a model that is stretched so thin that it can't bear its weight, that I think people kind of look around and see concrete conditions changing. I think imperialism is a great example of this, which we talked about as not a definite and well-defined stage, but rather that the characteristics that are identified as being part and parcel of imperialism are still actually perfectly intelligible through what we know about capitalism. And so, you know, Varoufakis is not by any means alone in this techno-feudalist moment, but I think what we always have to be asking ourselves is not the fear is that the concept is stretched too thin, but on the other hand, if a concept bears too little weight, then we suddenly have any concept appropriate and meant to accommodate any sort of change that we see in our lives or in the economy, which becomes unwieldy as well.
There are two motivations, I think. I should preface this by saying that Varoufakis himself is, you know, they had all these clips of DiEM25 meetings in which they argued in front of people that democracy and capitalism, their marriage is broken. We have to save democracy by ending capitalism. And then, of course, Varoufakis turns around and argues, well, it's not really capitalism. It's this kind of techno-feudalism, actually. There are two perverse incentives. On the one hand, there's this desire on the part of socialists to have access to what is one of the most robust intellectual achievements in Western civilization, right? Marxist critique of political economy, Marxism as such. On the other hand, of course, it's old and seemingly associated, unfortunately, with the past. And of course, lots of techie things have happened since mm-hmm. then, which, by the way, reading Capital would cause you to expect. But there's also that second perverse incentive. So on the one hand, you want to be current while having access to what is robust in Marxism. And then on the other hand, you want to be able to sell books and you want to be able to say that you're a professor of something at a university. And for that, you need to have novelty and, you know.
But I think there's something that is lost in this shift that is something lost at the level of political strategy and our vision for social transformation when we make these kinds of moves away from saying that we live under capitalism. I think, and this gets into one of the things that is most loathed about Marxism by our enemies and some of our erstwhile friends, but I think is actually really important and we lose here, which is Marxism is not just a critique of political economy and we wish the world were a better way. What it suggests is that like the class struggle is moving in the direction of capitalist development. That, you know, this is the whole notion that like it's not just anti-capitalism. It's preparing and giving a historical framework for an act of supersession for the for the working class to become the ruling class. When we say that we are no longer in capitalism, it sort of implies, and this, I mean, this we'll get into this later, but a lot of these new left populist movements kind of sort of explicitly say this, that the idea, you know, died with the Cold War, that the capital labor antagonism is the primary antagonism through which political action can be organized and motivated and et cetera, right? This is like this is just considered like cheap propaganda or quasi-religious dogma or something of Marxism. Whereas I think that actually like that we need to restore that notion, which is not just that we are struggling to, you know, build a world that is better, but that it is an actual historical generational vocation.
I think it also, there's also something very admirable when people do it, which is to make contributions to our understanding, but based on the foundation that Marxism has provided us, rather than deviating from it entirely to say that we're now in techno-feudalism and all of the ways that we used to explain the world are no longer appropriate, because we obviously do want to be mindful of and thinking about things like technological developments, as Stefan said, but we can't anticipate those through what we already know. And often, I think the real question is how this will inform tactical and strategic decisions rather than new theoretical models.
I mean, I think there are tech innovations and tech innovations. I was rereading Militarism and Anti-Militarism the other day for a separate project, and there's a wonderful argument in there where he says, well, if we invented magic sticks that could kill a man on impact, and they were incredibly cheap to produce. In fact, they grew organically, you know, and we had a perfectly democratic distribution of weaponry. That would radically change our political relations. So I take it that there are certain kinds of technical developments that do directly impact our political future. Those might be centered on arms manufacture, rather than other kinds of things. But these people want to replace every category in Marxism with something else. They want to replace the crisis, and Yanis Varoufakis' documentary does do this a little bit. You think there's a crisis of capitalism? You don't need a crisis of capitalism or a crisis of profitability. You can just have the eco-crisis, or maybe it's the threat of fascism and the crisis of democracy. That'll be your crisis, you know? We can provide you with a crisis under all circumstances. Also, oh, that proletariat, say goodbye to the working class. Oh, well, no problem. I've got the, what do they call them? The masses of ignored people, the people thrown out of the system, the masses of the you know, permanently unemployed and homeless, that which the society has discarded. Is it wrong? The society has discarded an innumerable number of people, or like an insane number of people? No. But is there no class struggle as a result? Of course there's a class struggle. In fact, there's a lot of political energy against what has been in this era of hyperinflation, what has been an impoverishment of the working class that people have reacted to entirely intuitively, and that the, you know, I don't know what you want to call them, let's say the establishment commentariat is trying to convince everybody that they're all either deluded by MAGA, and that's the reason why they're rebelling against their impoverishment, or perhaps they're just catching bad vibes because of Biden's age or some other cultural thing. What have I heard the other day? The vibe was, instead of a recession, it's a vibe session. Isn't that nice?
That's very, very good. That's cute.
Has New York Times written all over it. Yeah.
I mean, One thing, just maybe a slight tangent off of that, but it's related to what I was thinking about while reading this issue of Jacobin on AI, which I do want to start out by saying that we are going to be very cautious about not generating our own hot takes on AI because we don't know much about it. And I'm actually a proponent when you talked about the magic stick thing, Stefan.
Yeah.
I'm a proponent when it comes to technological changes of the Owl of Minerva approach. The historians will figure out how big this all was. But from what we can see right now, And the Jacobin issue was extremely well researched, better than anything I've read in the mainstream press on helping me to understand what's going on with AI. But I don't think that lets us assess the magnitude with which it will hit our world. And in fact, what I largely saw was that when they talked about the cultural and aesthetic concerns, the way it will be used in education, the way that it could, you know, potentially replace certain jobs, rather than something new, this is simply a very an acceleration of existing trends that we could always anticipate, because in fact, there will always be incentives to increase productivity. And whether those fail or not, there will always be those incentives. And all that really boils down to is an acceleration of everything that's already fucking bad about the world we're in.
Well, I'll tell you this, it's not like the internet, which is, I mean, you know, you want a candidate for transformative technology, that's it. It's not like the internet has been some great boon to productivity.
I want to pick up at that Verifaga sign, because it's okay. Forget, well, not forget. I want to pick up on the Verifaga line, the notion that if we conceive of ourselves as no longer inhabiting a political universe in which we can properly categorize as capitalist, and therefore the political, as Matt was saying, the political strategies and tactics that were appropriate to living under capitalism, and that we will call the Marxist or communist tactics and strategic repertoire, that we need a new one, looking to other things like the masses or the people. You know, this is what the whole left populism gambit is meant to do. And I think we should look at what we're missing and what we're throwing out with that when on the level of organization, the level of strategy, on the level of tactics, because how Syriza fits into that, or what allows people to make these sorts of claims and group these particular movements together. Usually, they're pretty obvious, but like Syriza, Corbyn, Sanders in the DSA, Podemos, Mélenchon's party, the France.
Thank you.
What categorizes them all together, and to what extent, you know, what their main alterations are to sort of the classic socialist framework, and whether or not we think, yeah, it's related to this idea that capitalism is a thing of the past.
What's the biggest difference? Is the biggest difference disassociation with organized labor? Is it that they're not trying to compete either outside the labor unions with new ones, more radical ones, or trying to take over the ones that already exist? I mean, one of the things that was missing from that whole Varoufakis documentary was any discussion of organized labor. And, you know, I just think that that's strange in 2024 when organized labor is all over the front pages of the newspapers. I mean, from the UAW to the ALU, you know, whatever you think of the position, whatever kind of socialist you are, I think that you would be silly not to think that we're in a moment where it's topical to talk about. And it just bears no relationship to the political strategy of the parties that you just mentioned.
I also think, I mean... It's very almost kind of common sense to group these all together as some sort of populist movement, because a lot of times the class distinctions were not in the foreground. It became more the popular versus the elite and things like that, which obviously can muddy and mystify the waters a bit. But I don't know that that's – I read a review of the Populist Moment book by Chihan Tugal in the New Left Review. And he made a really good point, which is that, you know, Podemos tried explicitly to dispense with the left and right idea and to have it more popular versus elite. Whereas, you know, you could definitely argue that Corbyn and a lot of the people in the Corbyn camp who had come from a communist tradition were not trying to do that. So maybe the thing that groups them together the most neatly and convincingly isn't the concept of populism, but rather the fact that in every instance, they did not manage to build lasting organizations, that the organizations had moments of expansion, but then immediately atrophied after the moment. And I think part of that, or a big reason for that, is that there are certain just entrenched ideas about what politics is that in the era where militant organized labor and mass political movements have been kind of fallen off the map, it's very difficult to imagine something else. And so even in something like the Sanders movement, there was always this language about this is our movement. But ultimately what it came down to is people were canvassing for Sanders in the hopes that this support would ideally lead to a point where they could internally generate and develop demands that he, as an external authority, would eventually confer, rather than have building up democratic organizations with actual ongoing activities, even in periods of downswing of the movements, at a local, regional, and broader level. And I think that lack of organization building is totally one of the defining features of that moment.
You know, one of the consequences of that is that the postmortems end up getting published, or, you know, whatever we're calling Vimeo, get distributed into a void. You know, it occurs to me that when the Hungarian Revolution postmortems get published, they get published in the mainstream organs of the party by officials of the party who are there to educate the general working class movement, which hasn't disappeared, whose organs have not disappeared, on what they should think of this particular defeat in the context of a broader struggle. Whereas, you know, I mean, it seems to me that one of the tragedies of having this moment, which, just as you say, Matthew, I think perfectly accurately, these organizations that spring out of the ground like mushrooms, only to dissolve again, the great tragedy is that there's no one around to talk about why they dissolved. Here's something that also occurs to me, which is that, you know, when I started to get into politics, not that I want to make this autobiographical, but when I started to get into politics, it was right around the time of the Arab Spring and the Egyptian Revolution. And it's not for nothing that the Muslim Brotherhood takes power in that moment, because the pivotal reason is because it has the organizational strength necessary to have bona fides in saying that we can make the water flow out of the taps. We can make, you know, society will not crumble. We will be able to, you know, handle things because we have got enough institutional memory. We've got enough party solidity that we can take power when the government falls. If the Washington regime were to fall tomorrow as a result of some populist upsurge, as a result of some general strike, I don't think there's any socialist organization on the ground with any kind of credibility to be able to run society in its wake.
Yeah, and there is that. To that exact point, when we give up let alone the capital labor antagonism as fundamental to social transformation, but when we give up the class war, the other thing we're giving up is a very particular notion of victory that the communist movement once had, which is the socialist revolution. When you don't know what your victory is going to look like, or if you no longer believe in the thing that we once called the ultimate victory, then it can become very difficult, even from the get, to plan a strategy accordingly. One of the things we see, yes, in these organizations, which I like to call just-in-time organizations, because they love this idea of, you know, they're hypomobile and fluid and flexible, and they meet this exact political moment, and they're made to order for these particular specifications. But this is a notion of the party or the organization as primarily a political instrument that's capable of seizing, quote-unquote, power in a very particular way. Gone is the sense of the party as the field of operations, or as a sort of territorial camp of our own side in what is a much longer generational struggle, yeah, in which our vocation is to raise the working class up to power. And it seems to me that one of the things that we don't see in any of these organizations is that exact notion, like you were talking about. Like, not only are organizations what give us continuity and institutional memory so that we're not speaking into the void.
Yeah,
and so that
the we ability can, to learn lessons.
Yeah, so that we can train each other. But they also give exactly that sense of permanence that is necessary to maintain through what should be expected to be catastrophic failures time and again. There's a great anecdote in, I think, several of these books that's used because it's so indicative of this old French communist who joins Mélenchon's party. And when he leaves, all he has to do is hit unsubscribe. and there's a world of difference, obviously, between that and what we've talked about before about the SPD. And I mean, that's obvious not to use like the two most extreme examples. But, you know, the SPD, when you say, you know, this is a party that takes care of you from the cradle to the grave, quite literally, we have socialist nurseries and we have socialist cremation societies. This is a different version of the function of organization than what we see today. There's no notion of what we might even call just a dual power strategy of creating our own orbits of social life. These are strictly, you know, electoralist vehicles that are trying to you know, win the zeitgeist at very particular moments. And they're all in parties. They're gambling on a very particular moment, which is the opposite of, you know, our party basically has to maintain itself over a much longer historical timeline.
So if you're right about that, and I think you are, then Varoufakis is exactly the wrong kind of hero. And I do think he's a hero. I want to come back to that for a moment. I think that he was really brave. I think he stood up to friends in moments when every single other member, seemingly, of that government was ready to capitulate to Berlin. And he was ready to resign. You know, there's something heroic about Varoufakis. And by the way, you know, he takes a tape recorder into his meetings with government officials and then releases those tapes. He is committed to a certain kind of, I don't know what to call it. It's a kind of demi-anarchism, individualist, you know, there's a liberal individualism that is really refreshing in him. And I think was historically important at a certain moment, but he's exactly the wrong kind of hero, because the kind of hero we really need is the one who's ready to sacrifice his own reputation for the good of a party. But of course, absent a party, there's only one other kind of hero you can have.
Right. And I think that part of the problem, of course, is that we talk about that we can kind of trace some sort of positive development over time in terms of political ongoings in our adult lives. Let's say that Occupy was the populist in the negative sense moment par excellence, which was just, you know, the popular masses versus the elites. And you could have landlords who hated banks marching alongside a communist, you know, things did get more sophisticated over time, but that wasn't because it was enshrined in an organization that struggles through these lessons and carries them forward. It's that certain people happen to learn the lessons and rejoin the organizations each time, which is, of course, a weakness. And Nathan, you talked about parties taking a certain kind of power as kind of an endpoint, and I think seeing it that way rather than an advanced stage in a process also leads us to a situation where you arrive somewhere and suddenly the imperatives of being a governing body, say, are you end up accommodating yourself to those. You are kind of reconfigured for compatibility with the way that governing has always happened. And if I can do a slight tangent, but just to bring it in, because I think it's actually very related to the problem of not having organizations that endure. When I'm thinking about the left media organs, a lot of times you'll finish a really great article and it will just end with something like, and this is why socialists need to take a place at the table. This is why socialists need to do this or that. And the fact is, that's not even a dig at these writers or these magazines or something. You really can't give that much more than kind of these abstract prescriptive things that we all agree with in the absence of an organization that they're responding to, that they're in dialogue with. When you're kind of unmoored and just speaking to socialists or a class, that doesn't mean much if there isn't an institution of that class or a socialist party that you are speaking to. And so in that sense, a lot of these magazines end up kind of chasing, I think often unself-reflexively, kind of just cultural flashpoints, because the same way that that parties can take on the assumptions and the terms of the parties that came before them, the media organs take on the predominant imperatives of the media ecosystem, which is obviously not good for left media organs.
There's when you're talking about an accommodation, there is a kind of like path dependency where it's like if your version of how we seize power is through these sorts of parliamentary mechanisms, if power is this thing to be sought and seized and not actually to be generated and wielded, which is like the basic insight of the dual power strategy, then you can sort of come up with these like, you know, we understand that politics is quite manipulable. This is not this is not breaking news to anyone, you know. So there are these like get rich quick schemes that are basically, you know, riding the wave. The thing that surprised me the most, and this is true, that genuinely registered as slightly unanticipated, and all of these, I think our contemporaries are reckoning with this, which is it's not so much the meteoric rise of someone like a Sanders or a Corbyn or a Podemos out of quote unquote nowhere, although I want to interrogate that in a moment. But it's not so much their meteoric rise and early rapid compiling of successes. And or even the fact that once they entered government and they found that like their program could not possibly match up to their aspirations, and so they sort of folded or accommodated to the regime, that honestly isn't that surprising to me either. It's that after a definitive failure, which we should expect, our historical episodes are constantly punctuated by failures, the apparatus and the mobilization and the organizations behind these things essentially collapsed, I think, much quicker than I anticipated. Yeah. The remaining, I mean, the remaining infrastructure of, you know, what was the Sanders movement is next to nothing. For something that was, which many leftists in America will say was a very defining and fun time to be alive for once, you know?
No, it's true. You know, the Obama was caught a lot of flack after he was elected, because many on the left believed that he had this power to organize young people in particular, and that these young people had poured into organizations associated with the campaign or also just maybe parallel to the campaign, but that Obama had left them all to hang dry, mm-hmm. you know, ignored them all. And I got to tell you, since we're speaking ill of friends, this is absolutely true of Bernie Sanders. I mean, you know, what happened to organizer in chief? I used to tell people on doorsteps that, you know, when they'd ask the skeptical question, how are you going to get Medicare for All passed? I used to give them my answer, which was, well, listen, you know, if a senator from Kentucky doesn't want to pass Medicare for All, then maybe the buses don't run in Louisville. Maybe the schools don't open in Louisville. I mean, if we have to force this open, we will force this open with the power of an organized working class, because instead of having a president, we're going to have an organizer in chief. It used to be something I repeated a lot. And it just doesn't seem to have any credibility at all now that, you know, now that Sanders is essentially, you know, internally a member of, a member of the administration, for all intents and purposes.
Okay, I want to like poke at something, because you sort of said it, and then I'm trying to figure out how convincing it is, which is, okay, on one hand, obviously I agree that like the explicit theoretical move, much beloved by the populist left, which is either the capital labor antagonism isn't central, so we've pivoted to something else, or that in order to create a properly majoritarian coalition capable of governing and taking power, you have to sort of expand beyond the sort of language of class warfare, and so to incorporate all sorts of other types of demands, and therefore by not focusing on the working class as such, or organized labor as the particular fulcrum around which social struggle will be decided, that these parties are incapable of living up to their aspirations, right? But obviously none. I mean, Syriza, you know, all of these, Syriza, Corbyn, Sanders, whatever, they're not disinterested in the question of organized labor. Mm. So I do want to...
Corbyn in particular.
Yeah, I do want to point out, like, okay, so what do we think that claim is? Because I read it all the time where it's like, oh, well, the problem with the left, the reason it fails, well, it didn't take a real account of the working class, right? It is often accompanied by a claim, which we hear very often, which is one of the problems with these organizations is their class composition, mm-hmm. by which what we mean to say is that they have become hegemonized by whatever we want to call this. You know, the popular term now is the PMC, this sort of like quasi non-class of, you know, whatever, pick and choose whatever characteristics you want. They're higher educated, they have better jobs, they, you know,
petty bourgeois intellectuals.
Petty bourgeois intellectuals. And, you know, the class is sort of, the party is supposed to be taken over by them, and it's not, working people don't want to join it or whatever. And I'm just curious, I guess, is that an element of the critique that you're trying to lodge, or are you trying to lodge something about a sort of specific political function assigned by these organizations to the organized labor movement?
Yeah, it seems to me that in order to be functional, the socialist movement has to be the political arm of the organized labor movement. That's going to be made up of some people who merely want a union and are advocating that that political arm, that political organization of the party, force the laws to change such that it'll easier for them to join one, or they're members of unions already and are part of perhaps militant minorities, or maybe they're members of militant unions, ones that are really avant-garde. Maybe it's, you know, Smalls and his cohort. Either way, I think that the, you know, this is an old story, right? But organized labor in this country has been completely co-opted by the Democratic Party, that it sees as, just as Matthew said, an external force from which they can excise demands. And I think that that strategy for them as organized labor becomes more militant, which I think is the direction things are going, is not going to be long-term viable, partly because the Democratic Party doesn't need them or doesn't think it needs them anymore. And if that's true, then the hope is that the political battle is between those who think that a labor party, the role of a labor party, is to reestablish democracy, reestablish competitive capitalism, and provide for a, you know, Keynesian style welfare state, and those who believe in the demise of the Washington regime and the replacement of a pseudo-democratic republic with a direct democracy, a council democracy, and a revolutionary regime. That debate's healthy and historical. But as long as there is no political arm, because we imagine that organized labor isn't the motive force of history, but instead just another interest group, there'll be no muscle on the left.
Yeah, I think there's two things going on in that question that Nathan posed too, and I completely agree with what you just said, Stefan. And I think one really interesting thing, we've also been studying the Hungarian Council's Republic for an upcoming episode, and I loved that even when the workers were in these Soviets and were in favor of the revolution, there still had to be external people who would come in to make sure they weren't hewing too much to the narrow self-interests of their union. And so obviously organized labor breaking away from the Democratic Party and creating organizations of its own with multiple militant unions congregating is obviously a way to expand the class struggle. And that would be an amazing thing to see. I think the other side of it is one that I tire of hearing, and that seems to be more like being annoyed with one's peers, which is the kind of PMC argument, or that there's kind of a dilution, the peer class element is diluted by these graphic designers and, you know, middle managers and things like that. And I think, of course, that just can't hold water, because what a lot of those new class theories come back to are honestly not that different from the idea of the aristocracy of the labor and the fact that certain people can be bought off and therefore they are terminally conservative and smitten with the status quo. And we can just see that historically that's not true. A lot of the most militant people in workers' parties throughout history, and a lot of our heroes who have developed our best theories and committed themselves the most to the struggle, have been in these elements. And I think that this kind of weird idea of a chemically pure working class is actually the problem. Not that we're not seeing one in our organizations. I remember, as an anecdote, a very funny one. We were in a group that Nathan and I were in at a meeting. He was advocating going to a conference with various left groups in LA. And, you know, there was kind of this hesitation among certain people in the meeting that these are self-selecting leftists. They aren't, you know, in the unions and things like that. And somebody just posed the question, will there be workers there? Which is very, very funny, because as Nathan responded very quickly, well, I don't think there will be capitalists, right, which is the real question. And so PMC or new class theories come in, a lot of what they're attempting to do, which I don't think Marxism should ever attempt to do, is to explain attitudes or to predict behavior. And that can't possibly be what our theory of class struggle ends up doing.
So I completely agree with that, and hook, line, and sinker. What I was trying to differentiate, which the two of you have done quite adequately, is a sort of this PMC adjacent argument, which is a constant worrying about the class composition of the organizations. And this is based on this argument you can hear all the time, so I don't even need to really directly quote people, but that one of the things about the PMC class is, because of their ambiguous class position, they can be taken either way to become apparatchiks of the ruling class, or, you know, hopefully better militants. Of course, a statement like that is only important or meaningful if it also derives from an assumption that people with unambiguous class positions are more likely to have unambiguous political positions, which is simply not the case. Even the hard hat organized union worker can in fact go either way in the class struggle. That's actually, you know, just historically true.
Yeah,
and we have to reckon with that. I want to say one quick thing about, so differentiating that, a sort of worriness exclusively with class composition as a demographic solution, and what Stefan was talking about, which is what the actual problem is. What is the actual non-link that we're creating with the organized working class? It's not, oh, we have to go organize the working class out of some sort of deep fetishization of the working class as such. It's because we have a specific purpose in mind for organized bodies of direct producers. And this is why even, you know, Sanders or Corbyn are people who care about organized labor and are trying to adequately, who are trying to emphasize those groups, why their strategy still is insufficient. Because it's not just we want organized workers because we need the working class. It's because we intend to build institutions to devolve power to these people. So it's not a class composition problem. It's a political strategy problem.
So the PMC are too tied to, say, the liberal establishment and therefore will always cut off their ties with the working class, which they have organic ties to by virtue of their economic class position, in favor of, I don't know, in favor of the administrators of the university or perhaps the shareholders of the business they work for, because they're, you know, they're upper management or they're data analysts or whatever else, or Yale right. grads or whatever else. Or is that the bigger danger? Or is the bigger danger, patriarchy and racism among, among the white working class in Michigan? You know, they're just, equally drawn to, to the political opposition of the right. You start to blame the composition. When I couldn't agree more with Nathan, when in fact it isn't class composition that's the issue, it's your political goal in the first place.
Yeah, it's an errant political strategy that can't prioritize the working class because absent the strategy of the socialist revolution, of the council of democracy, right. There actually is no reason to prioritize the working class.
Part of it is this idea that the workers are just another special interest group, and then it becomes problematic that some members of the special interest group don't want their interests, given into, or, they don't want concessions based on their interests, and that's so confusing and politically bumfuzzling. But in fact, not at all. The struggle itself is an education. The culture of workers is something that is built in the context of class struggle and does not pre-exist it.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I think part of the problem is even this yearning to identify and point out somebody's composition or somebody's class position absent an organization that they are actively participating in. One of the ways that I think we can often misuse class is to wonder what it means if, your uncle works at Rite Aid, but also rents his back house, as I think we brought up in the agrarian question episode, actually, that sort of thing. And we can't just think of class as some cartography, and there can be infinite different categories. And this is why I'm sometimes okay with abandoning at least somewhat the model of science in favor of ordered thinking, because I think the temptation to do kingdom, genus, phylus, and species for every single possible class position is actually a bad one. What matters, and this is what I was trying to formulate when I talked about who a socialist media organ is addressing, what matters is that it's addressing an organization that is behaving in certain recognizable class ways, as Ellen Mikeson's Wood would say about behaving in class ways. Class formation and class process is how we identify class, rather than picking up individuals and identifying where they might be. And so the only real way to coherently talk about or to address or to intervene in these sorts of debates is to intervene in them as they take place in organizations with goals, with challenges, and with questions that they're grappling with.
Yeah, at the end of the day, the class anxieties, which are very real, I also don't think the revolution will be led by an army of graphic designers and Hollywood writers.
Damn
like
it.
To be extremely,
they're
extremely
so cool,
clear.
Though.
But the problem, fundamentally, is one of an errant political strategy that has already decentered the working class. So what we see is the result of a model of social transformation that does not necessitate a class revolution and therefore has already displaced its own constituency from its own organizational model.
And this is what's so empty about this idea of democracy without capitalism. I mean, if you're not going to tell us what the organizational form of that is going to be and what kind of an organization, I mean, what is DiEM25 but a political party? And okay, it's novel because its idea is international electoralism. That's relatively novel, actually, in the history of socialism, where you take one party rather than you take many socialist parties and then bring them together international. You take one political party and have it create branches in many countries as possible, and then try to run for parliament. That's, I mean, I commend them for the amount of success they've had with that strategy. All the same, I need to know. A democracy? Sure. But this is an old Giorgio Agamben. I can't believe I'm quoting Giorgio Agamben right now. But yeah, okay, democracy. But in what state? You got to tell me what kind of state it's going to be.
There is one other element that I do think is kind of oddly unremarked upon in all of these phenomenon, specifically Sanders, Corbyn, Podemos, Syriza and Tsipras, and Mélenchon, which is, you know, for obvious reasons, the talk is about the new institutions that spring up and congeal around these figures mm-hmm. and experience rapid periods of growth, momentum, DSA, or revolution, Podemos and Syriza. Syriza has a longer trajectory. But nonetheless, one of the things that is interesting to me is for all their talk of these are the new digital parties, these are very novel, that we're done with archaic forms, they congeal around a very specific type of figure, mm-hmm. which is someone who in each case received their political training and was embedded at the origin of their political life in one of the institutions that we are claiming the organizations, you know, are responses to those becoming archaic. The interesting thing about all five of those figures, Tsipras, Mélenchon, Corbyn, Sanders, and I understand that there are various shades of red, but they are all red diaper babies. Mm-hmm. And I really think that there is something to not just the fact that they were able to speak to a sort of credibility or legitimacy by virtue of that institutional experience, but I really believe it's something like fluoride in the water, that there is some trace of the commitment and permanence in the ideology of the communist movement or the socialist movement at its peak. This exact thing that we're saying is dead forever and that we need to replace. It's not for nothing that the first expressions of the new political model had to congeal around some of the remnants of that experience. And I'm not convinced that given that we are now in a truly post Cold War, where the new political class will almost certainly not have that experience, I don't know that it will be able to produce them.
But your point is well taken, which is that there is institutional memory that is on the one hand salubrious, right? Because it gets us in touch with that bloodline that we find so informative. But on the other hand, I think in a case like Varoufakis, who really is a red diaper baby, you know, it gives him this sense of new generational responsibility. I have to innovate in light of the failures of the past. Right. And that I think is distracting.
Yeah, there is something. I mean, the thing about the red diaper babies is, yeah, I think it gives them a sense of, I don't want to say reading the moment, but a sense of political fortitude that is absent in the contemporary political culture. I just don't see people. I don't see today's, like, you know, media savvy political youth
demonstrating.
You know, demonstrating.
Yeah, no, not in the slightest. And you know, those rooms are still 80-year-olds and 20-year-olds.
Well, also the aspirations of a media savvy political class are as yet unclear. All Owl of Minerva again, but I do think that, like, the aspirations do seem, as we've talked about, largely not to be to kind of formalize lasting institutions, and where those lessons can come from is an open question, because I think they're important fucking lessons.
The historical nature of communism is not to be underrated as an attribute as attributable to its successes when it was mm-hmm. accomplishing them. One of the things that Anton Yeager and Borriello say in their book is that populism fails it because it offers social democracy without social democracy, which is to say some sort of kind of a policy package that looks like social democracy, but none of, like, the sort of organizational repertoire that we associate with the classical high point of social democracy. I particularly liked reading that because people who have heard me at the bar know that I refer to social democracy itself as socialism in absentia, which is socialism without socialism, which is to say it itself is, again, a policy package that is meant to, you know, sort of make the world look a little bit more socialist, but without, as we were alluding to before, the necessary component part of the working class in power, the mechanism of power being vested in organizations of direct producers. I am reminded suddenly of a question that you, Stefan, posed once at a talk where we saw, I believe it was Brenner and Bhaskar, talking about, you know, the prospects for social democracy or something. This is probably 2016 or something like that. And I've thought about this often, which is, you go, you know, they outline their prospects and what their program is and everything, which is basically what you would expect. And you go, you know, the thing about it is your best case scenario worth wanting? Because if it's not, and this is important, because if it's not pitched as a liberation struggle,
right,
and for the emancipation of the class and all that good stuff that we're supposed to throw away because it's just romantic and utopian, if it's not pitched to that level and if it's not worth wanting, then it turns out you can't mobilize people for it and become a world historical force for a better world. It just turns out you can't.
Yeah, being a socialist, I mean, being a socialist, and by the way, this is also my definition of what it means to be gay, which has nothing to do with what who you sleep with. It's who you're willing to be buried in a mass grave with. That's all it refers to. And, you know, that's true of socialism, too. I mean, it has to be worth wanting it. And in fact, I mean, this goes back to maybe one of the key elements of the organizational question. It has to be worth sacrificing something for, something of yourself. Maybe not your life, but certainly your comfort and reputation. If you're not willing to sacrifice that, then the organization needs nothing from you, in which case there might not, you know, you may not need an organization at all.